And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for the second hour of our show. Do the laundry, pick up the kids, make dinner. But before that, stop by the grocery store to get the chicken to make for dinner. Call your mother about her doctor's appointment. She wants you to go with her. Email the boss about vacation days and make plans for those vacation days, please. And on it goes. The to-do list for American parents is never ending. Maybe it was always thus, but it's hard to believe that. When did we get so busy? And why has busyness become something of a status symbol in our culture? Our guest this hour, Washington Post writer Bridget Schulte, looks at the pace of modern life in a new book, Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play, When No One Has the Time. The book is part memoir and part examination of the United States and why we lag so far behind other countries when it comes to the support of working parents. In fact, the Obama administration recently held a White House summit on working families to address the challenges that working parents face and what policy changes can be made to deal with that. Consider some facts. The United States is one of the only countries in the world with no paid leave for parents. And working parents combined are putting in about 28 additional days of paid work per year than they did three decades ago. You get that? You're actually working 28 additional days per year than a previous generation, 30 years ago. And women, even more so than men, are feeling the effects of this crunch. In this country, mothers today are spending more time taking care of their kids than mothers did in the 60s. Now, I know you don't believe that, but we're going to hear about that during this hour of the show with Bridget Schulte. And that's even though so many more women are working full-time jobs outside the home. So Bridget's going to unpack that for us. And doing the research for her book, Bridget Schulte, who is married, mother of two children, came to realize that her own struggles with time management were, in fact, shared by parents from coast to coast, which is why she wrote the book. I'm not the only one trying to get a handle on the contours of the crazy jangle of modern life. So what's to be done about this? Bridget Schulte, it's nice to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bridget Schulte is a journalist at the Washington Post. She also contributes to Washington Post magazine, right? And this book is your first book?
It's my first book.
Way to go. And you've been getting some nice mileage out of this because people want to talk about this. This is one really hits home.
It really does. And what's been really kind of fun and exciting is that everywhere I go, I'm still a reporter, so I always bring my notebook with me, and I've got hundreds of more stories now and story ideas of things to write about just from talking to people all around the country.
Well, let's invite our callers in on this subject. So if any of the things we talk about during this hour ring a bell with you, strike a chord, give us a ring. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And you can address a question for Bridget by email or make a comment about your modern life, this modern life, midday at wypr.org. Let's go over something first. Is it really different today than it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago? I mean, I read some of the statistics from your book here, but some people will find it hard to believe that life is even tougher or busier than it was 30 or 40 years ago when, you know, before TVs had remotes and that kind of thing. You know what I mean?
right. Before we had, self-cleaning ovens and all
yeah.
of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there are a couple things that are really important to remember. And that is, life has changed dramatically in the last couple decades. When you're looking back in the 1950s, 1960s, the majority of families had one parent stay at home, usually the mom, and one parent go off to work. And so they had sort of this division of labor. Somebody was working and bringing home the bacon, so to speak. Somebody else was doing all the stuff that you needed to take care of the home. You had economists say that was the most efficient way to run a family. Well, then a couple things happened. For two reasons, women started entering the workforce in really large numbers in the early 1970s. 70s. And the two reasons are, one, the women's movement opened up opportunity for women, opened up possibilities for doing something in the public sphere, not just the private sphere. And at the same time, wages started to stagnate and they've been stagnating really ever since the early 70s, even though productivity has been going up, even though costs have been going up. For instance, we were just talking about college just privately before the show, mm-hmm. and, you know, college costs have gone up 1,000% since the early 80s. You know, who's had 1,000% raise? Nobody. Well, unless maybe you're at the 1%. Mm-hmm. So you've got these different pressures now where you've got men and women juggling work in the public sphere and all of the private stuff that it takes to run a family and to raise kids. You've got, at the same time, these intensive standards for what we consider a good parent, particularly a good mother. And some of that is all very much tied into the sense of what's happening with the economy. We don't know what the future holds. Our wages have not been going up, even though we've been working harder. For white-collar workers, the hours that we work have been on a steep incline since the early 1980s. And nobody really quite knows why. I was just talking to an economist on the way up here. It's like, why do we work so much harder when it's not necessarily that we get money from that? Some people do, obviously.
We work long hours, right?
We do.
The unionization has gone way down. The number of jobs that are under a collective bargaining agreement has gone down with manufacturing in the United States.
That's
it's been
right.
parallel with that. So, you know, there were controls over the amount of hours you worked and whether you got overtime and whatnot. And it seems that a lot of that is just all gone.
Well, you know, the one law that governs our workplace really and our hours is the Fair Labor Standards Act. That was passed in 1938. That was, you know, at the time, incredibly progressive. At the time, people's work hours were 10, 12 hours a day. The U.S. steel industry in the 1920s, a typical shift was 12 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week. And it was Henry Ford who brought in some internal researchers and kind of investigated his own auto plants. And he wanted to know, how far can I push a manual laborer until they get so tired and sick and stupid that they begin making a lot of mistakes and cost me money? That's right. It's counterproductive. And that's when he determined, you know, I get a plenty of productivity out of an 8-hour day, 5 days a week. So he shuttered his factories on Saturday. Everybody flipped out in the National Manufacturing Association was like screaming that you can't do this. This is terrible. He cut work hours from 48 down to 40 hours. And then what happened a year or two later? Wow, he was productive. He was profitable. He was making more money. His product was better. He had well-rested and happy employees who then had more money in their pockets because he also raised their wages.
And they could buy a Ford.
Right. And then they had the leisure time on the weekends to actually go out and drive them around. So it was sort of good for everybody. But that's still the law of the land. And so what had been very progressive in 1938 is still what we've got today in 2014.
I'm convinced now. I was intrigued by that number that I read at the beginning of the show, Bridget, about the 28 additional days of work per year than 3 decades ago. That means when you take in all these hours, when you total them all up, that's what we end up with.
Right, and that's paid and unpaid work.
Paid and unpaid.
That's paid work and the work that you've got to do. Because really, when you think about it, if you've got two people working for pay in the marketplace, somebody's still got to do the grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. Somebody's still got to cook dinner. Somebody's still got to do all of that work. And this is something that Arlie Hochschild, the sort of renowned sociologist, came up with back in the 80s, 25 years ago. She came up with this book called The Second Shift, where she documented that it was largely women still doing that second shift, that they would go to work. And then because that's been the women's traditional role for centuries, that hadn't changed. And I was just at a conference in New York where she spoke, and she said, I've got good news, I've got old bad news, I've got, you know, new bad news. And honestly, there's a lot that's changed, and there's been a lot of progress that's been very hopeful and exciting. But The bottom line is, on average, women are still doing about twice the housework and twice the childcare, even when they're working full time outside the home. And a lot of that is, frankly, what I call the movies that we play in our head. You know, it's been so clear for so many centuries that women are the primary caregivers, that even though their roles have changed, our attitudes kind of haven't caught up with that, that we're still sort of stuck.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking about that. What is our impression of how the world has changed in that regard with women? That someone else takes care of their kids, or if they can afford daycare, yeah, I guess so. That would be necessary. But when they get home, what do they just pick up a magazine, sit and relax while somebody else cooks dinner? I don't think so. So we might have an impression that because women are working outside the home, they're not spending as much time with their kids. In fact, they are. They're still doing it, right?
Right. Well, and, you know, to your earlier point, you know, our impressions of women. Well, one of the other things that hasn't changed is what we expect of men. You know, honestly, we expect men to get a job and work until they drop. And that hasn't changed. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the last couple of years about women leaning into the workplace. But, you know, for women to really be able to lean in fully, men have to lean out and help at home. There has to be more parity, not only in the workplace, but also at home.
Right.
And when you talk about the statistics about mother time, that was one of the most surprising things to me, even though in sort of sociological circles, it's not. It's something that they've been tracking for a while. And really, when
that mother time's been consistent.
That mother time's actually been rising since the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
even though women are more and more working full time. We've got something like close to 80% of the mothers of school age children work in this country, and many of them full time. We have one of the most, you know, populations in the world that has a lot of working mothers. So what's really interesting is there was a study that came out that said, it sort of confirmed everybody's worst fears, that mothers were not spending time with their children. And the media went crazy. Mothers abandoning their children.
Mm-hmm.
Working mothers are heartless. They're horrible people. You know, and it's certainly something that as a working mother, I internalized. I felt that real guilt all the time. What was interesting about that when I was doing the research for the book, though, is that study was wrong. And when the researcher discovered that he'd made a miscalculation and corrected it, it was already too late. Nobody likes to go back and say, oh, hey, that big blockbuster story we had a couple months ago, well, it's wrong. And,
right.
You know,
so that may still be in my mind here as I'm sitting with you,
so,
having this impression about women.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting is when you really look at the data and they started to unpack that, what they noticed is that women started giving up time. The housework time, when you look at the charts, it's really fallen down. I mean, we are not polishing the floors and the, you know,
mm-hmm. The silverware.
And the silverware like yeah. we used to. So women's housework time on average is way down. Personal care time is down. We don't, you know, go to the beauty salon, or we don't take care of ourselves as much as we used to. Time with other adults has dropped off. We don't spend time with other adults, friends, as much as we used
to. And general leisure.
And that's the biggest thing,
yeah.
is that women have given up almost every ounce of personal leisure time to spend with their children. And really, what happens then when you look at international comparisons, American mothers, even though so many of them work, spend about the most time with their children of mothers in just about any country, any advanced economy that they've looked at.
Bridget Schulte is our guest, a Washington Post journalist, author of her first book, Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Who is your publisher, Bridget? It's Sarah Crichton Books.
Sarah Crichton Books, Farr,
yeah.
Straus, and
Giroux. I hadn't seen this imprint before, Sarah Crichton Books. I think you're our first Sarah Crichton author.
Well, she's fantastic. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Sarah Crichton.
Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. We want to take some phone calls during this hour. If you'd like to commiserate with Bridget Schulte on this, give us a ring, 410-662-8780. Do you consider yourself strapped for time? If so, what do you do to seek relief? How do you manage your time? Were you a poor manager of time with the kids and your job? And how did you figure that out? We'd love to hear from you this hour. Please call in and commiserate, 410-662-8780. This is Midday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick sharing this hour with Bridget Schulte, and we hope with you, 410-662-8780. Bridget Schulte visiting us from the Washington Post today, where she works as a writer. Her book is Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Here's a question that came in from our producer, senior producer, Nikki Gamer. I'll read this one to you. She says, a common thing to hear from the overwhelmed worker is, I wish I had more time to read.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose this medium, meaning this book I'm holding here, this 300-page book, impeccably researched book, as the way of disseminating your findings to those people who already are overwhelmed? Do you think that making time to read your book is the first step towards reaching time serenity? I love this phrase, by the way, time serenity.
I love that phrase,
So is this
too.
What you're trying to do, get us all to read your book, to take time out to read and find that serenity? Is that it?
That's hilarious. It's a really good question. And I have to be perfectly honest, it's a question that I've been getting a lot. How can you write a book for busy people and expect busy people to read it? And honestly, what I'll write back is I'll say a couple of things. I wrote this with busy people very much in mind. And so each chapter reads like its own standalone. And so one of the things that I tell people is you can read the whole book. And when you say 300 pages, a lot of that is the end notes. It's very well researched because I was very sensitive. I didn't want to write a quote-unquote mommy book. I wanted it to be very serious-minded, but have, you know, really great reporting and great stories and have fun, but also be really grounded in the research.
It's a work of journalism.
It is a work of journalism. Yeah. So really, it's a work of scholarship as well. And believe me, I hadn't done EndNotes since college. I had to relearn how to do those, you know? So I don't want to freak people out. But you can read the whole journey. You can read just the chapters that appeal to you. You can read, I have bright spots of really hopeful and cool things I found out there where things are shifting to kind of give you hope. Mm-hmm. And then I have an appendix in the back that just gives you sort of all of the great advice that I learned along the way. Or you can get the audiobook.
It's an audiobook too?
There is an audiobook, yes.
You could do this while you're driving the kids around.
Yes, right.
Time serenity. Just talk about that. I like the idea.
I love that term. One of the terms I came up with to describe how my life felt as I started writing this book was time confetti, because that's what it felt like. Like
little pieces of here and there.
Exactly. Yeah. Shards that really don't add up to anything. And as I started reading more about the time use, there's a whole field out there, time use research, which I didn't know anything about, and now I've got 4 filing cabinets full of time use studies. And what I love is they have 2 terms. One is called time adequacy, and that's the sense that you have enough time in the day to do everything that you feel like you need to and want to. And that's sort of the first step toward what they call time serenity, where you just feel okay about everything. You don't feel time pressure. You don't feel crunched or squeezed. And so that's why
you haven't put too much on your plate then.
I think that's
you have adequate time to do what's on your plate. Well, so if you add something to your plate, it's less time, right? Then you're getting back to confetti.
Well, it's true. But I think that you raise a really important point is to get to that sense of time adequacy or time serenity, you really have to look at what are you putting on your plate? What are the decisions that you're making about what's important to you? And I think what happened to me is that you get so busy, you don't have time to make the choices of what's really important. So you put everything on your plate. And then your expectations for what you can and should do are so unrealistic that you're constantly feeling behind and that stuff's falling all over the place and that you're inadequate at work and you're inadequate at home. And so to really, one of the first steps, you know, the book really calls for change on the big level, the structural and workplace level and laws, but it also really looks at, well, what can you do here and now? And that's probably one of the most important things you can do is find even a little moment to pause, really get clear about what's important to you and what are you going to put on your plate so that you can find a way to feel that sense of time serenity today.
Let me ask you one more question, and then we'll start taking some calls, Bridget Schulte. Busyness, BUSYNESS. Some people wear that as a badge. You know, being a really busy person means you must be a really important person, right?
Right.
You visited a woman named Anne Burnett, who is a professor of gender studies, women and gender studies up in the North Dakota state. So you did some traveling.
I did
some traveling for this book. Was that Fargo, by the way?
It was Fargo, North Dakota.
Oh, great.
That's right. Wonderful movie by that same name.
Yeah. So tell us about this, with you, a little bit about busyness and people wearing it almost as a boast, as a badge.
Right. Well, like you say, I did travel for the book, and I went to Paris for a time use conference. I went to Denmark. I have a fascinating chapter in Denmark. I went to the Bay Area. I went to Colorado, and I went to Fargo, North Dakota. And I did that because I wanted to understand this sense of busyness and ask that question that you asked me at the beginning of this of our talk, which is it really different now than it's been before? Why do we feel so busy or anxious? And so to be perfectly honest, there was a researcher in L.A. that I was going to be spending time with who studies the frenetic pace of life.
And he was too busy
to
talk to
you? He was too busy. He called me up and he said, I'm too busy. I can't do this now.
So that's how you ended up with Ann Burnett?
Well, it made me go back to the research literature. I was totally freaked out. You know, with a book, you have a deadline, but it's a pretty significant deadline and, you know, you got to hit it. And so all of a sudden, my chapter three fell apart and I thought, what am I going to do? I went back to the kind of the academic literature to see, well, who else is studying busyness? And up pops Ann Burnett and she's in Fargo, North Dakota. And I called her up. I said, you're kidding me. You're the national expert on busyness and the fast pace of life in Fargo? And she said to me, it's like, oh, honey, do you want to meet some overwhelmed North Dakotans? I can arrange that.
They're everywhere.
And she arranged a focus group that I was able to sit in on, and it was fascinating.
So does she conclude that some people add to their plate, add to the agenda because they think that makes them more important? What is it? But if you're a busy person, you're an important person?
Or? Well, that's really what a lot of her research was finding. She was doing a lot of interviews with people analyzing the language that they use. And one of her main things that she studies are Christmas letters. And she has an archive that goes back to the 1960s. We spent the whole day just going through year after year of all these Christmas letters that she's collected. And mind you, they're mainly from the Midwest. So it's not like LA or New York or, you know, Washington or Baltimore. It's like a big urban center that you would think where people are frantic and busy.
And what does it reflect over those 50 years?
And what you could see was a real speed up. Whereas, you know, reading the letters from the 60s and 70s was much more about greetings of the season and we're reflecting about our lives and we're so grateful to have you as friends and family and it's beautiful. It was crazy. Some people were talking about like, oh, our lives are so nuts and I drive 100 miles a day and at the end of the day, I feel like I've been thrown against the door like a, you know.
It's in those Christmas letters. It's like a newsletter that people send out to friends and family.
Right. And she said they became gradually more and more of these kind of boast sheets. And what people were boasting about was how busy they were. And that's when it hit her. She said, people are bragging about how busy they are. It's become a status symbol. It's like, if I'm not busy, I'm not important. Hmm. She said it's the new keeping up with the Joneses. And I thought that was a really interesting, her research is really interesting.
It doesn't sound healthy.
No, it's not healthy. And what was interesting is her contention is that we have made it such a cultural value to show your worth by how busy you are, that we will even create it when it may not necessarily have to be there. And that's another thing to keep in mind when you're talking about what you have on your plate. And if we think that to be important and worthy, we have to have a whole bunch of stuff on our plate that just sort of, you know, it loads, it's from the start, we can't ever win.
Well, going back to the workplace for a moment and what's valued are people who are completely devoted to the workplace, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
An employer looks at somebody who's let's be honest, single, no kids, especially when it comes to a woman, right? That person is more, I know studies indicate this, that person is more likely to get a promotion or even become a partner in a law firm or something. Right?
Well, the interesting thing is fathers are actually, up until now, the social science literature shows that fathers get what they call a fatherhood bonus. They are the most rewarded workers at work, but only if they work like fathers did in the 1950s, which is all the time, you know, FaceTime, be there, you know, almost act as if they don't have a family. But because they have a family, they're rewarded with more money because the workplace culture thinks, well, you know, now they have to provide for their family. They're going to be a more dedicated worker. So again, those old movies are playing in our heads. And social science is showing that that really is playing out in the workplace. Women, whether you have, if you don't have kids, the pay gap between men and women is very narrow, but it's still a pay gap. But what they found in the social science research is that mothers are particularly penalized. They call it the motherhood penalty. When you look at the wage gap between mothers and fathers, it's an enormous gulf, even when they're doing the same work.
Bridget Schulte is our guest in this hour of Midday, author of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, about our busy lifestyles here in the 21st century in the United States. 410-662-8780 is our number. Let's take a call here. We'll get started with Eileen in Baltimore. Eileen, thank you for calling. You're on with Bridget.
Oh, thank you for calling upon me.
Okay.
I recently moved to Baltimore from New York, and I am searching around for people to be friends with and there's no one because they're all too busy. One woman rushes into Starbucks, greets me friendly, leaves with her coffee, is gone. She has to go to work. But that's not what I'm calling about. That's the ordinary story. I'm calling about my niece, and I will try to preserve her privacy as much as I can. She is she's a nurse coordinator. She works 40 hours a week, and she can telecommute, I believe, for part of that. Her husband also is a nurse. He works in the ICU of a local hospital, 36 hours, which is a full three shifts, which is a full time. And when he is home, he is available to take care of the children, so they reduce their child care costs that way. And during the day, my niece is also available for the children, I don't know to what degree. They have, listen to this, 5 children, ages 8 through baby. And they plan, I'm sure, I mean, I haven't asked them, of course, but according to their religious beliefs, they must have more because they're not allowed to practice birth control. They are religious Jews, and they're very faithful. Mm-hmm. This is not a cult. They are normal, and she's extremely busy during the week.
So, Eileen, are you calling just because you're standing there looking at your niece and her husband and their family, wondering how do they do it? They're just so busy all the time?
Well, how they do it is they're so busy all the time.
Yeah. I mean, that is how they do it. They're just constantly running, I guess. So, Eileen sounds like she's a bit in awe of that. I must say, you know, 5 children and the jobs she described, I would be in awe of that, too. When it comes to children, by the way, because kids are such a big part of this, you mentioned socialization before, or lack of socializing, that for women in particular, that a lot of the socializing you do is through your children when you have them, when they're young and you're before the nest is empty, right?
Right, right.
That's how you find make your connections with others. But the kids are around almost all the time.
Well, it is true. Pretty much all of our leisure time is spent with our kids. And what we're also finding is that as men, particularly younger men, particularly those who have had working mothers themselves, as they are becoming fathers, they want to be more involved at home. They don't want to work like the 1950s ideal worker dad, and they're having a real struggle. And so what you're finding now is more and more studies showing that men are feeling more work-life conflict and more stress than women are. So I think what's interesting about this family, they talk about having 5 children. So many people do not have families that size anymore. Our family size has really been small.
Right, that's unusual.
That's very unusual. And at one point, that wasn't necessarily so unusual. And part of that is because of our workplace cultures, expecting people to work as if they didn't have children and really punishing people in many cases if they have caregiving responsibilities. People tend to put off having children until it's almost too late. That was certainly the case with my husband and I. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to get to a certain place where you feel you have a little bit of standing, that you've proven yourself, because you're so worried that you'll be seen as a lesser worker or less committed if you go out on maternity leave. And you know, then when you start late, you can really only have 1 or 2. And when you look at what's happening with our birth rates, when you look at what's happening by education level, the most educated in the United States with some college, they're having, it's 1.1, which demographers call baby strike or crisis rate. And so you really have to ask yourself, when the people in this country with the most education and the most resources are waiting so long and feeling that they can't have children, you really do have to ask about what's this larger picture that we've created for them, for everybody.
And another large problem out there for people is finding childcare. First finding it,
yes,
and then being able to afford it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
This is another thing you explored.
Yes. The child care and education is second only to mortgage and rent in most for most families, and that's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Child Care Aware of America has done a study where the cost of college is actually less expensive than child care in more than 30 states. To be affordable, they say you should have about 10% of your income go to childcare. But there are plenty of places for low-income folks where it's so much more than that. In the United States, we have no standards that govern the quality of childcare. We have We really don't have any kind of system that knits it together. So what you've got are NICHD study said most of the childcare is there's some really great childcare. There's some really dangerous child care, and the vast majority of it is pretty mediocre. And it's very expensive.
And other countries have standards for it?
Other countries do have quality standards. Other countries have subsidies from the government, which we do not have here. And that's something that our political system does not support. But we are... it really puts the burden on parents to pay an awful lot right out of the gate for childcare. It's not, you know, college, you got 18 years to save. Babies, they come right away.
Bridget, I want to ask you this question. Given all that you've described so far through the first two-thirds of this hour with me and in your book, do people have an awareness, do Americans have an awareness of what's going on? Are we... I mean, you'll hear somebody, a friend will say, I just feel so overwhelmed. Or a spouse will say, I feel so overwhelmed, right? People will blurt that out once in a while because they're having a day like that. But they don't really change anything, right? They just continue on, trudge on.
Right.
I'm offering that question to you, whether we're even aware that this is happening to us.
No, I think that you are right on. We are not. I was not. When somebody asked me what was the most surprising thing about the book, and I said my own ignorance. My own ignorance is what surprised me the most about this book. And it was interesting. I was talking with a researcher about family policy all around the world. And one of the things that I asked her is, why? Why is the United States really, why do we rank last on virtually every measure of policy or law that would help working families? And she shook her head and she said, you know, I don't really know, other than maybe Americans are just used to being miserable.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's really an interesting point.
Is that where we are?
that we just think that we have to suck it up and soldier on and push forward. You know, part of it is we have a very individualistic society. We are built on the rugged individual. We don't want government help. We don't want to pay taxes. We don't trust the government. That's certainly the mantra of a lot of the conservative movement since the 80s.
And libertarians, right?
And in other countries, you don't have that. You have very different political systems where there's more trust of the government, where there's more of an expectation that it's a community job to raise the next generation, that you want to invest in your society. We don't have that here. Children are seen as a very much of a private and individual kind of responsibility. And it's really something that we've got to open up and start talking about.
And we're talking about it this hour. Bridget Schulte, our guest, because of her book, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, about our busy lifestyle here in the 21st century. 410-662-8780. We just need to take a short break. We'll come back and start taking some more calls for Bridget. Please join our conversation. You can also send an email. I've got a couple of emails to read here. midday@wypr.org. One of our listeners called in, Bridget, to remind us that during World War II, lots of women went to work and also had to take care of their kids. Rosie the Riveter is an iconic figure.
And what's interesting about that is a lot of the men then were overseas, obviously. So a lot of the working mothers were single moms. And the government did step in at that point. We do know how to do this. They created Lanham Centers. And there were child care centers, really wonderfully high-quality places for kids to go. And at the end of the day, they'd often send, roast chicken home in a foil with the moms. So we do know how to support working families. We've done it before.
Let's take some calls for Bridget Schulte. Betsy in Sterling, Virginia, thank you for calling. Go right ahead with your question.
Hi, I have a question and a comment. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, does the author have any thoughts about why women are spending more time with their kids in extracurricular activities and that kind of thing than they did back during the days when there was actually more time to spend with kids than there is now? It seems to me like there are a lot more demands for parents to be at school functions and after-school functions and evening functions on weekends, that kind of thing, than there used to be in the days when June Cleaver and my mother – used to send us all outside after school and not expect to see us until dinner time.
Yeah,
right.
And I'm just curious about whether that perception on my part is true. That's my question.
You're absolutely right.
I just drew a picture of a helicopter here, Bridget. I can't believe. Look at that. Oh, good. Helicopter parent.
That really looked like a little firefly, but no.
Sorry. It's supposed to be a helicopter.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, it's true. Back in the 60s, when women were home, there was this sense that because people were home, you could send your kids out and play till the streetlights came on. That's certainly how I was raised. That's how I grew up. And there is this lament that kids, we don't let them, we don't feel like they can, we don't feel like we can let them have this kind of unstructured time, which frankly kids do need. There is too much hovering, too much helicoptering, and there's plenty of good science that's emerging that's showing that that's not good for anybody, that kids don't need that. They do need time to themselves to develop a sense of who they are and what they like, and they can only do that if they have time to noodle around and figure that out, maybe choose something and fail, learn how to pick themselves up and try something else, to develop a sense of grit or perseverance. And we get them so scheduled because we're so worried that we're not spending enough time or that they're somehow missing out on childhood because we're working. I think there's a lot of guilt. So we do overschedule. The standards for what we expect of mothers are really off the charts. And part of it is, you know, have you done the right swim team? Have you done this? Have you done that? And so that's part of why I sort of ask people to take a pause. And again, going back to that plate analogy, what do you want to put on your plate? Are you putting everything on there that you think you should because everybody else around you is? You've really got to figure out what's your own internal compass, because the pressures are pretty intense around you to overwork and overparent and overdo. And we all have this kind of very human sense of not being enough or doing the right thing. And you've just really got to, even if it's a few breaths, you've got to pause and kind of jump outside of that and really find a way to create that sense of what's important to you. Because
it's hard. It's hard, though.
It's hard to do.
It's a hard judgment to make. When you're a parent, you're thinking, I better do this and I better do that. And what if I don't do this or deprive my child of this, do not provide this opportunity to, you know, for ballet or this opportunity to ride a horse or this opportunity to play ice hockey? Who knows? I mean, I shouldn't deprive my kid of anything because I'll be limiting his or her possibilities.
That's a huge fear, yeah. And we want to make sure that we're doing the best for our kids. But I think what's really important to remember, it's like researchers call it an inverted U curve, that there's a sweet spot. You do want to expose your kids to activities and to different things, because when they do different things as children, they're more likely to try different things as adults. So we know that some activity is a good thing, but too much is not better, and way too much is actually worse. And so it's sort of like more is not more. You've got to find the sweet spot.
Let's take another call. Jennifer in Baltimore, you're up next. You're on Midday with Bridget Schulte.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to say that I realized, I guess, when I have two children, an 8-year-old and a 3-year-old, and when after I had my first son, I realized how time constraints were taking over my life, and I had an hour commute to work, and I worked on the weekends as well, and I cut it back. We bought a house. It was 5 minutes from my job, and my husband works crazy hours, so I cut back work on the weekends and no working on weeknights, and we did with less. We made do with less money, and you know, I see all my friends, you know, going crazy. You know, they don't have enough time. They don't have enough time to spend with their kids. They don't have enough time to do everything that they need to do. And we just decided that it's just not worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. But you really, you know, one of the things that I was really struck by as I was researching the book, you know, talking about working crazy hours, and that is really so much of the culture in so many workplaces. You know, why do we think that we have to work these crazy hours in order to be really good employees or to do good work? And that's really, it's something that I would ask every worker, every employer, every workplace, because I tell you, I've come across so much really great research out there that working long long hours does not make you a better employee. In fact, we don't really know for knowledge workers. We know that for manual labor, you can work about 8 hours and then you just start making mistakes. We know that for doctors and residents and truck drivers, you can only work so far before fatigue sets in. For knowledge workers, we really don't know how long can you sit there and think and do knowledge work before you become, frankly, a butt in the chair. And there's good evidence that it may not be more than 6 hours a day. So what we do, though, is we spend long hours of face time. But I would argue there's plenty of research that shows it's not very productive time. And it's not good for work. It's not good for workplaces. It's not good for families. And it's not good for life. So I think that that's one of there's a big message in the book. It's like we've really got to look at the way we work.
I'm glad Jennifer called, because that speaks to that question I raised before about self-awareness, even awareness that this is even happening to us. But if we like being miserable, do something about it.
Right.
Aaron in Baltimore, you're up next. Thanks for calling Midday, Aaron.
Hi. So I'm a 29-year-old college student. I'm also a veteran of the United States Air Force. And my wife and I have made the conscious decision that until I'm employable, because my disability precludes my ability to actually work in what I was trained in, that until I'm employable, we're not having kids, because we know that having one person working and one person at home all the time is a recipe for one of us to start resenting the entire system.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought about it, because you said at the outset of the show that used to be considered the ideal by economists, the most efficient way.
Right.
Right.
But
for one to be to bring home the bacon, for the other one to cook it.
Right. But, you know, what the economists don't keep in mind is what are people's hopes and dreams and ambitions?
Right.
You know,
it's changed.
Well, I would even argue that's why we had, Betty Friedan in the 50s. You know, it may have been economically efficient, but people don't work like rational little factories. You know, we all are, we're all complicated. There's all sorts of feelings and ambitions and dreams that we have. And, I think that's really important what the caller is saying, is that particularly for families, as you begin to form your own family, to have some really very specific conversations about what the future looks like and what you both want out of it. And you'll see in one of the chapters in my book, you know, my husband and I thought we did, but we only did it in a very abstract way. And then 20 years in, you know, I found out I was doing everything. And that really had to do with both of us. And
how did you find that out? Did you actually analyze your clock? Or what did you do? Did you keep a log of what you actually do?
How did I find out? Yeah. Well, you know,
I mean, you're a journalist, so you give me the facts.
No,
right?
I was just gonna say, let's see, cleaning up from the 11-year-old's birthday party, and he was out in the back smoking a cigar.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
That was a pretty good indication.
Right.
But I tell the story in the book.
But see, if I was your husband, I'd want to log here to see. Wait a minute. I dumped the dehumidifier at 10 a.m. You know, I want some credit for what I do.
Well, right. And, certainly men are doing more than they used to. And my husband certainly did more than his father did. I would say there's a scene in the book that I talk about, a Thanksgiving that was probably when it became very apparent and was the lowest moment. And that was, we're going to have 18 people over. Why? Because I think Martha Stewart was living in my head and, you know, trying to be the perfect mother and the perfect housewife and perfect worker and trying to do it all perfectly, and the kitchen looked like a bomb had gone off. We'd run the turkey trot that morning. I was still in sweaty running clothes. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. My husband comes over to the refrigerator. I think he's gonna, you know, put the turkey in, and he takes out a 6-pack of beer, and he goes over to a friend's house to help him, quote unquote, smoke his turkey.
Wow.
Basically means, you know, drinking on the patio and having a great afternoon while I'm doing all the work. And that's when it became really clear that things had gone really wrong in our relationship. And I was very angry and resentful. Hmm. And what we started doing is we worked with this place called the Third Path Institute that I found. And it's really the only place that I found that's actually working on both sides of the work and life equation to try to help couples figure out, well, what's fair for us? Because it's not going to be the same for everybody. Sometimes one spouse has has a big job and the other one is more flexible. Sometimes they both have big jobs. Sometimes they're both flexible. Sometimes they want to be more traditional. You have to make the decision what kind of family you want, but then she helps. And my husband and I wanted to have an egalitarian, fair marriage. And so, honestly, I say that the Thanksgiving story, it's a redemption story because we both learned. We both saw the movies playing in our heads. I totally bought into the idea.
So are things in more balance now?
Absolutely. So much better. You know, I have to say, just even this morning, you know, I was supposed to take the kids to the doctor last week. I did. He took him to the dentist. He took him today. So, yes, much better.
Way to go, Bridget. Here's an email from Terrell in Ohio, listening through the NPR app. A lot of people's time and stress challenges seem to be related to child rearing. Most of my friends are so excited to start families, and then as soon as they do, they seem to disappear into their life responsibilities. What is the lingering obsession with having children, and do young people seem insightful about the impact that parenting will have on their overall life satisfaction? Well, our previous caller, I seem to be thinking about that. But that, and you alluded to it earlier.
Right, right. There are...
They're putting off having children or not having them at all.
Right. People are delaying. People are not having kids. And I do think that that's a real problem. You know, there's a biological imperative. Humans are wired to, you know, propagate the species. It's what, you know, that's sort of what human nature is supposed to be doing. So it's a really important thing to look at what's... why that's so difficult, and why young people are not wanting to make that decision.
Marielle, you're up next. Thanks for calling Midday. Go right ahead, please.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to comment that, well, I guess I'm the exact opposite to the previous caller, because I had a child as a single parent, and it was kind of spontaneous, and I just kind of had to roll with it. And the way I roll with it is just let the dishes stay in the sink. My house is a mess all the time, whatever. But there's like a sense of community. And within the school, kind of letting your guard down with this, like everything has to be perfect. I'm so afraid to let anyone into my life that I'm risking being connectedness and I'm risking community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of have a network of other parents, not all single moms, but just other parents and other adults, and we all kind of get together and have a beer, and the kids hang out, and they, you know, hang out in the field or go on a trampoline, or they, you know, hang out in the house. And it's just really nice, because when you have that sense of community, it makes it easier, and when you're all kind of in it together, you're able to work together.
I'm glad that Marielle called. So someone is thinking, we've had a couple of calls here where people are thinking about, are conscious of what's been going on, how busy they are, and how to make adjustments, how to make it better.
Well, I think the caller has just an absolutely wonderful, wonderful story.
Yeah.
And it brings up two things to mind, which is good enough is the new perfect. You know, perfect is out. And again, it's going back to those unrealistic expectations and feeling that we're not good enough, and the cultural pressures.
And you have to be the ideal mom, right?
The ideal worker, the ideal mom. Yeah. You know what? We got to let that all go. Good enough is good enough, and right now is good enough. And the second thing she talks about is having a network of support. That's so critical. When I spoke with Sarah Blaffer Hurdy, who is the foremost expert in motherhood, you know, in the world.
Here
really.
And now is next. Here on your...
Keep going.
Oh, okay.
Bridget.
Sorry. So when I spoke with Sarah Blaffer Hurdy, you know, one of the things she talked about is mothers have always had help. Always throughout, you know, ever since the, you know, Pleistocene era. And what's different now is that so many people expect mothers to do it all alone. So having that network of support is really critical.
Bridget, thank you for coming in today. It was nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I appreciate this conversation a lot. A lot to think about here. And from Bridget Schulte's book, again, published by Sarah Crichton Books, it's Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Bridget Schulte from The Washington Post has been our guest in this hour at Midday. Thank you again.
Thanks so much.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Have a pleasant afternoon. We'll see you back real soon here on Midday.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.